I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. When the scientists Stanley Pons and Martin Fleischmann at the University of Utah claimed to have discovered cold fusion a decade ago, the networks, the newspapers, even parts of the scientific community were abuzz with excitement. The puzzle of a cheap and limitless energy source had been cracked, it seemed, but then no one could reproduce the scientists' results. Eventually, the theory, and Pons and Fleischmann along with it, were discredited. For our guest, the physicist Robert Parker, was a classic case of voodoo science, self-secluding scientists wary of peer review, uncritical media coverage, and a public all too ready to swallow the miraculous news. The term voodoo science, Park says, encompasses a well-defined range from foolishness to fraud. There's pathological science, where scientists fool themselves. There's junk science, where scientists use their expertise to befuddle and mislead. There's pseudoscience, which has the trappings of science without much evidence. And finally, there's fraudulent science, which is outright lying. It's not just homeopathic medicine that raises Robert Park's red flag. It's also the Star Wars program at the Pentagon. It's Deepak Chopra's quantum alternative to growing old. Connection listeners, we have voodoo science under the microscope this hour. The phone is 1-800-423-8255 to make the voodoo science connection, or 1-800-423-TALK. Have you heard, as a lot of people have, that cell phones cause brain cancer? And when you do hear something like that, how do you distinguish between fake science and the real thing? 1-800-423-TALK makes the voodoo science connection with Robert Park, a physicist. I wish you'd begin, Dr. Park, by telling us the cold fusion story all over again. I remember watching Dan Rather sort of announcing a new millennium, so to speak, and then it was over. What happened?
It was over pretty quick. It was pretty much over in 5 months. But there are still people today that meet every year to talk about cold fusion, a dwindling band of true believers. It's 11 years now since that announcement was made, actually on the 23rd of March in 1989. And it was certainly an exciting claim.
Did it fool you?
Well, I was skeptical at the beginning, but that's only because I'd had experience in putting hydrogen into metal lattices. Most people, of course, had not had that experience, including most scientists. So these were reputable scientists. They had to be taken seriously. But it violated a great deal of what was known about nuclear physics. And these were not nuclear physicists. And so there was skepticism from the very beginning. But the initial public reports all sounded very optimistic. Hmm. And that's sort of typical of these things.
How should we have known? And I'm asking sort of as a citizen, but also in the news media, how do we test this stuff?
Well, what you usually do is go ask other scientists, you know, what is your view on this? And I got a call actually from Bob Bazell at NBC, who is, I think, a wonderful science correspondent. And he said he had been calling around, and the difficulty was that the physicists that he talked to all said, this is probably wrong. But then when he asked them if they would go on the air and say that, they declined. Hmm. And I think that's really what the problem is, that the scientists are a little too reluctant to speak out. Voodoo science is no great threat to science. It's kind of an annoying background noise that rarely rises to the level that it interferes with genuine scientific discourse. But for the public, it's another matter. And scientists like to imagine that the whole problem is that the public is not scientifically literate. And I keep asking, what is it you want the public to know? I mean, there is so much going on that we have a hard time keeping up on our own narrow specialties.
I'd like you to detail, as you do in the book, some of the specific areas that you worry about. Homeopathic medicine is one. It's a little exotic. But I'd also like you to talk about the fear of radiation, which a lot of good guys feel. Paul Brodeur, for example, has a big constituency through the New Yorker magazine for the fear of all kinds of radiation that's out there.
Yeah, well, his particular concern that aroused the most public concern was power lines.
Exactly.
And, which actually is not true radiation. It's a time-varying magnetic field fluctuating at 60 cycles per second. It's in what scientists would call the near field. It's not truly radiation, but it was always described as such. And the concern was that this was somehow causing cancer. There's a problem here, and that is that that all cancer-inducing mechanisms that are known do so by breaking chemical bonds, and there is simply not enough energy available in power line fields to ever break a chemical bond. It doesn't even come close. It's the shortest wavelength radiation that can break a chemical bond is in the ultraviolet. Even down in the visible range of light below the ultraviolet, there's not enough energy there to break a chemical bond. And it's not a matter of the intensity of the field. It's the energy in a single photon. It's a little like trying to hit an object across a river with a rock. If you can't throw that far, it doesn't matter how many rocks you throw.
But Paul Brodeur is a serious man. I don't know that he's an advanced scientist, but he's certainly a skillful journalist. And the New Yorker magazine certainly must have its own sort of peer review of stuff like that. And it's also addressed to a very sophisticated audience. Where do you classify that in the voodoo department? Is it fraud? Is it folly? Is it just a mistake or what?
Well, there's a lot of things going on here. Part of the problem is, of course, it's also entertainment. If you're the New Yorker Magazine or CBS News or WBUR, you've got to entertain your audience, and they're not going to listen. It's got to be interesting if that's the form of entertainment. In the case of voodoo science, the coverage is often by people who really don't have any science background, and that included Brodeur. Brodeur was not a scientist at all. A good example of that, in fact, was a claim of a perpetual motion machine that was carried quite credulously on CBS News. Now, you know, there's a double standard here. CBS would not think of having somebody cover the Super Bowl who didn't know that a tackle is an ineligible receiver. But they have no hesitation about sending somebody to cover a demonstration of a perpetual motion machine that has never heard of the laws of thermodynamics. Mm. So that's part of what's going on. But I can cite examples for you. There is one PhD physicist who is a science correspondent on television, and his coverage of cold fusion, even in recent years, has been largely credulous. Again, I think largely for the purposes of entertainment.
Let's talk about the Pentagon voodoo science and Star Wars. I mean, but every scientist I can find, including some that worked on the project, will tell you that's an emperor with no clothes. And yet, politics, surely, and even the media pay it a kind of lip service. What's happening there?
Well, you know, that's a serious problem now. Now, we're not talking about homeopathy, which is pretty harmless. When you're talking about something like Star Wars, there is the risk of actually destabilizing the nuclear standoff in the world. Russia or the Soviet Union at that time might have decided when we started building Star Wars that if this thing worked, it would destabilize things, and maybe they should launch a first strike. They didn't, but this is tricky stuff. And it's hard to believe that our leaders could have made this decision when there was so little scientific support for the idea, and yet they did it. It was perhaps in the opinion that it was good politics, and we're going through it again. Of course, we're now in Star Wars 2, And once again, politicians are rushing to assure the
public.
Well,
where's the voodoo? Is the voodoo in the coverage? Is the voodoo in the sort of non-scientific civilians at the Pentagon, or are the scientists in on it too?
Well, there are certainly scientists in on it too. There is absolutely no question about that. And one of the first rules is that there is no scientific claim so preposterous that you can't find a PhD scientist to vouch for it. And that's true whether it's a government program or an expert witness in court or whatever. Now, the scientists often rationalize to themselves that look, we're given a task and we do the task and what's made of it is up to other people. But I think that's a little disingenuous, and I think the scientific community has a responsibility to speak out more firmly on these issues right from the beginning.
How do we tell? Give us a quick citizen's guide to voodoo science.
It's not easy to tell, and again, that's why it has to be, I think, the scientists that take the lead in this. But there are a few things to look for. If there is one characteristic that is kind of overwhelmingly common in voodoo science, it is isolation. The scientists either choose to isolate themselves, or the research is secret. They do not publish their papers in the normal peer-reviewed journals, this kind of thing. They cut themselves off from scientific debate. Now, every scientist is going to make mistakes in his career. It's a normal part of science. It's a kind of a community project among scientists. Our responsibility is, and we hope our colleagues from time to time will grab us by the lapels and shake us a little and explain to us that we're getting carried away with our ideas, and here's what's wrong with it. And as soon as you get isolation, sometimes it's fraudulent. More frequently, it is the scientist, it's self-delusion. They're excited at the prospect that they might have discovered something really, really important.
Speak, for example, to the point we've mentioned about cell phones causing brain cancer. Lee Atwater, the man who isn't there to manage George W.'s campaign, who did manage his father's first campaign, went to his grave, I'm told, saying that it was cell phones that caused the tumors in his head, and there have been others. How does a citizen test the truth of something like that?
Well, it's not easy, and the jury, to some extent, is still out on that one. The cell phone now is very different from the power line. The frequency is much higher. The wavelength is much shorter, but it's still not enough to break a chemical bond. So it can't be inducing cancer in any direct way. But a microwave frequency does do one thing, and that is it can heat tissue. And, of course, we do this every day with our microwave ovens. But the fields here are much, much weaker. And the question is, could it produce enough heating in the brain, which is right next to the little antenna on your cell phone, to actually cause some problem? I would be astounded if that were true. I mean, I and a lot of other people go running in the middle of the day in the summer with the sun beating down on our bare heads, and yet our brain temperature never rises at all. The body has all the mechanisms it needs to regulate the temperature. It simply increases the flow of blood to the brain to keep it at its proper temperature. And it would be amazing to me, with the very small power levels of a cell phone, that the brain could not handle that.
Is somebody testing it?
People are looking for it. The studies are being done. There have been studies in the past when the problem first arose, when the questions about it first arose. The early study that was done was to compare people who used cell phones with people who used mobile phones in their automobiles. Now, the difference with a mobile phone, now very few of which are left now because people have turned to cell phones, but at that time there were still plenty of them on the road, and the antenna is not next to your head. It's outside the car.
Right.
And so that should be quite safe, and then you look to see if there's a some sort of a comparison there that you can get figures from. And the early results showed that there was no problem at all. In fact, statistically, it seemed that people who were using cell phones, the only real difference between them and the rest of the population was they lived longer. But the reason for that, of course, is a confounding factor, and that it is that at that time, at least, the cell phones were a tool of the affluent. And people who do have more money go to see the doctor more often, eat a better diet, all the other things that that may affect this.
I wonder, our guest, Robert Park, is a professor of physics at the University of Maryland. His new book from Oxford University Press is called Voodoo Science, The Road from Foolishness to Fraud, and it's kind of a citizen's manual to decoding a lot of the scientific or pseudoscientific claims that you hear among the miracles. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. John is on the line.
Hello, Christopher.
Welcome, John.
How are you? Big fan.
Thank you.
Interesting topic. I know a number of my colleagues have gotten out and gotten wires to put in their ear, which attaches to their cell phone for the fear that there is something to worry about in terms of changing molecular structure. Your guest had talked about microwave technology to a much lesser extent being used in cell phones. Therefore, the argument comes up where there must be some, at least not, maybe not a lot, but at least some molecular changes going on when you have that kind of energy source going directly into your ear. Lastly, I wanted to point out that when I put my cell phone up to the radio in my car, when a call is about to come in, there is a tremendous pulsing that you actually hear in the speakers. And it seems to me that there is some energy being emitted. And I do believe that there are varied frequency powers between different cell phones. And I can tell you, mine is seems to pack a lot of power.
John, I want to put it to Robert Park. Is John onto voodoo or is he onto science?
We're now sort of at the interface between the two, perhaps. Certainly, I acknowledge that there is certainly energy being deposited in the brain. And the question is simply, can the brain take care of that? Can it use its usual cooling mechanisms? And that's what we're trying to find out. There's a lot of study being done right now. If a cell phone makes you uncomfortable, don't use it. But I frankly think there's little room for concern. There are no statistics yet that show that there is any increase in the incidence of brain cancer corresponding to the increase in the use of cell phones.
John, thank you for the call. 1-800-423-8255. The Voodoo Science connection. Ken is on the line.
Good morning.
Welcome, Ken.
John. In the late 1600s, early 1700s, the search for longitude at sea was an overwhelming obsession for both navigators and politicians alike. And as we know now, in hindsight, John Harrison was in fact correct by continuing his efforts to discover longitude at sea through a piece.
You read Davis O'Bell's book, and so did we.
Exactly. And okay. As a graduate at the Harvard Ed School, I've seen some of the instruments. And Sir Isaac Newton would have gone on the radio and said, this is voodoo science. In fact, it has the hallmarks of voodoo science as just...
Well, now, wait a sec. Did Newton say that about...
Oh, Sir Isaac Newton would have gone to his grave saying that this will be solved in the stars. This will be solved by math. This won't be solved by a timepiece. And in fact, anyone purporting to solve this problem by a timepiece is sheer lunacy. And
wait a sec now, Ken, because Newton was assigned, in effect, the same mission... to master longitude, and he didn't. But do we know that he trashed Harrison's solution?
We know that anecdotally, and we also know that quite literally from the reports that Newton would write when reading about John Harrison's first, when he brought in H1 and H2 that in fact didn't work fully. But Sir Isaac Newton, nicely put, he poo-pooed the idea that a timepiece would solve longitude at sea. And the fact that John Harrison worked in isolation, had the characteristics of a voodoo scientist, leads one to think that there is some hubris in saying that we can now identify what voodoo science is in the present day, when in fact you need hindsight. You need to have the perspective. And I wonder if your guest would address the fact that if he were addressing John Harrison, he would, I believe, characterize his work schema as being that of a voodoo scientist.
Robert Park, would you?
No, I don't think so. I certainly hope I wouldn't have. Let me give you another example, because this comes up very frequently. Your question is a good question, and it's one that that I get asked quite frequently. The example I like to take, it was the argument by the physicist Alvarez that the extinction of the dinosaurs was related to the impact of a huge asteroid with the Earth. The amount of data that he based that on was very slight, and most geologists ridiculed the idea initially. The result of that, and the proper role for scientists, is to be skeptical when there is a claim made in which there is not very much evidence. But the result was that those who thought that Alvarez might be right began collecting data. And before long, they discovered that this thin layer of clay that he based his judgment on extended all over the world. And everywhere there were traces of life below that layer of clay and nothing above it. Ultimately, they even found the crater where it impacted. They found the debris washed up on the shores. There is now hardly a geologist left who has any doubt at all that the Chicxulub impact was the event that led to the extinction of the dinosaurs. Hmm. So this is simply science working. And as long as everybody is obeying the rules of scientific discourse, it works fine. The fact was that Alvarez published his results, other people published papers contradicting it, but it was all in the open literature. And he's eventually the truth was determined. Enough evidence was found to tip the scales, and that's precisely the way it's supposed to work. We make people make their case more clearly, and that's exactly what happened with the longitude problem. The people who saw that, in fact, that might be the solution simply had to make their case more and more clearly. And, of course, eventually they won.
Robert Park, would you address, as you do in the book, the matter of magnet therapy, biomagnetic treatments, the wearing of magnets to get closer to Earth forces?
They're
used to keep us straight. Who's policing that subject?
Absolutely nobody is policing that one, and this is a great example of voodoo science. In the first place, the claims that a magnet might help are generally based, although there are a number of different claims, they're generally based on the idea that somehow it improves circulation of the blood. And the usual claim is that because blood contains iron, the magnetic field will attract blood to the site of an injury, which helps in the healing. Well, the problem is that the iron in blood is in the chemical form of hemoglobin, which is not ferromagnetic. It is not attracted by a magnetic field. And in fact, there are a couple of little tests that the listeners can conduct for themselves on this. In the first place, if you want to get blood to go to some spot on your body, where you pick a spot where the skin is pale, if you're a pale-skinned person, and use a hair dryer, and you'll find that heating the skin a little bit in about 60 seconds, you're going to see it begin to flush. It's going to turn red because blood is rushing to the area once again as a coolant to keep the temperature down. Now, but there's a second problem. Even if blood were attracted by a magnet, for almost all of the devices that are sold, there is no magnetic field penetrating into the body at all. Now, you can buy a therapy magnet if you wish. You can test it with a refrigerator magnet, which is made the same way. A refrigerator magnet, which is thin and wide, is actually kind of a masterpiece of modern technology. It's not easy to make a thin, flat magnet that is magnetic across its whole surface. And the way they do it is by making it with alternating north and south poles. So there are little strips, usually only about a 16th of an inch wide, of alternating north and south poles put together to make those magnets. The result of that is that a very, very short distance away from the surface, which is where magnetic fields are measured. When you see a magnet rated at a certain number of Gauss, it's been measured right at the surface. And that works fine for posting a Dilbert cartoon on your refrigerator, but if you put very many Dilbert cartoons under there, you're going to find that it doesn't work anymore.
You're putting it down, but all kind of athletes, especially golfers, swear by this stuff. What's the impulse behind it, do you think?
Well, there are two things that go on here. We always say the placebo effect, of course, and that is simply that that the mind does have some influence over the body, and if it relaxes you, you may heal better or think you're feeling better. But the other thing that goes on is that almost all the things that afflict us, we get over anyhow if you just wait a while. Hmm. And whatever we're doing when we get over it almost always gets the credit. So in one of the events that I count that I
hold a thought, will you, until we come back from the break?
Sure.
Robert Park is our guest, professor of physics at the University of Maryland and the author of Voodoo Science, Drawing the Line Between the Merely Fabulous and the Foolish and Fraudulent. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Voodoo Science Connection. Magnets in circulation or power lines in cancer. We haven't even gotten to Deepak Chopra's quantum alternative to growing old. Robert Park is our guest, physicist at the University of Maryland and the author of Voodoo Science, The Road from Foolishness to Fraud. Give him a call at 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. You were just speaking, Robert Park, about magnets in circulation.
Yes, and I should point out that at one time millions of people swore by bleeding as
purging,
as a cure.
Yeah.
Yes, purges, bleeding, all sorts of things that we now know are either worthless or even harmful.
Hmm.
So the one thing that science has learned is that you don't want to depend on anecdotal evidence. There's just not much to be learned from a few individuals who believe they have experienced this or that. You've got to do controlled studies, and that's what has brought this whole revolution in modern medicine about, is the understanding that you rely on controlled, double-blind studies.
Stand by for callers. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Voodoo Science Connection. Neil is calling from Baltimore, Maryland.
Yeah, hi, everybody. Hi, Christopher. Hi, Dr. Walk.
Welcome, Neil.
I just wanted to make a little comment about the magnets. The doctor points out two things, a placebo or a self-healing mechanism. And I wonder if he has any experience with the use of magnets for post-operative healing. And I'll give you an example. I had hernia surgery 2 years ago. And placed a magnet over the incision, never had any black and blue, never had any swelling, and never took a pain pill. And I repeated the same procedure last year on some eye surgery. And I know hundreds of other people who have done the same thing. I know people who are hit by line drives and put a magnet over the area. They don't turn black and blue. Without getting into a long argument over what the mechanism is that does that, it's clearly not a placebo. It's clearly not self-healing. And I wonder how Dr. Park would explain that as voodoo.
Yes, well, as a matter of fact, the former quarterback for the Miami Dolphins, claims that that magnets helped his broken ankle heal. But the only way that you could have taken that seriously is if he had broken the other ankle and then just used a magnet on one. So until you do that controlled experiment, once again, if there is one lesson that science has learned, is that these anecdotal evidences really don't add up to anything. They may be suggestive. They may suggest an area where you want to do some research, but they don't substitute for it.
Neil,
they're not anecdotal stories.
They are.
As to bone healing and soft tissue healing, there's a very fine textbook on the subject that the doctor can read. It's called Biological Effects of Electromagnetic Fields by Dr. Charles Polk and Dr. Elliot Pasto.
I know the book well.
Polk writes a very nice section on soft tissue and bone healing. There are literally thousands of people who will tell you that if it's a normal 4-week break, it will be healed in 2 weeks.
Okay, then let's do a double-blind study and find out. Nobody has
published by Weintraub on neuropathy using magnets, diabetic neuropathy and peripheral neuropathy using magnets.
There are any number of studies that have been done that show no effect at all. And in fact, the better studies show no effect. The studies that have shown effects are often very small statistics, and frequently it turns out that the person publishing the study has a financial interest in the company that makes the magnets. Hmm. There are several cases of that. And Consumer Reports, in fact, I think we'll be doing a story on that soon. So, it's just not science until you do the double-blind studies, and those haven't been done.
Neil, I just want to get a last word from you. I mean, do you see science here, or are you just celebrating something that brought you out of your hernia surgery well?
Do I see science? I see a lot of science. I happen to be a physicist, just like Dr. Park. I happen to be very well educated in the field of magnets. I happen to have spent years looking at...
What do you think the magnet effect is? He says it barely penetrates the skin.
It probably doesn't.
Well,
first of all, that's not true. Penetration is a function to a large extent of the thickness of the magnet. So if you have a paper magnet on a refrigerator, he's absolutely right. If you have a magnet with thickness, it will penetrate. You can penetrate 4 or 5 inches, and most of the activity occurs in the first inch of the body anyway. The mechanism is up for debate. There are lots of people who talk about the Hall effect. There are people who talk about this hemoglobin problem. There are people who talk about the effect of mitochondria and ATP. There are lots of explanations. Do we know the explanation? Of course we don't. But what explanation do we know about almost anything in the body? Can we totally explain aspirin? Can we totally explain antibiotics? Can't explain anything in the body. To this day, we don't know what causes cancer with all the money we've spent. I treated, talk about placebos and voodoo science. I was diagnosed with prostate cancer a year and a half ago, refused a radical prostatectomy, and treated myself with cesium, nature's most active element, and that's it.
Let's hope you're right, Neil. Thank you for the call. 1-800-423-8255. Makes the voodoo science connection, or 1-800-423-TALK. Cimarron is on the line.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Cimarron.
I'm going to switch phones here.
Okay.
I wanted to talk about astrology, which I think is a great example of pseudoscience.
You for it or against it?
Well, that's a good question. When I was younger, I was very interested in it, and I studied with an astrologer, and I was fascinated because it had a lot of interesting aspects. It appealed to my sense of a large set of data being correlated to people's births. It was interesting from the standpoint of the mathematics that you needed to actually calculate a chart. And after a lot of work and research, I decided it wasn't valid because after looking at some studies that were double blind and so forth, I determined that it was really just a bunch of bunk. But be that as it may, it still enjoys obviously a lot of support. It's in the newspaper every day. Whether you want to believe it or not, there's a lot of people that have believed it for probably thousands of years.
It can't be 1/10 of 1% of the people who check their sign in the paper that believe it, though, do they? Or?
Well, that's a really good question. If you look back in history, astronomy really came out of astrology because, you know, the people that were looking up at the stars were trying to figure things out. So at one point, it wasn't pseudoscience, it was science. I think it all depends on your viewpoint. But I'd be interested to hear what our guest has to say about the fact that, you know, this has lasted a long time, and I think it still does have quite a few adherents, and, you know, this is, I think, a very fascinating area because, you know, on the face of it, it sounds like it could be true.
Let's ask him. Robert Park, you worry about astrology?
Well, I don't worry about it, no. And, you know, that's kind of over the edge as far as my book goes. That one's too far to even bother with. But all superstitions persist for thousands of years. It's a characteristic of it. People want to believe these things. It's astonishing to me that people want to believe that the stars control them, but they hate believing that their genes do. I've never quite understood that one.
Cimarron?
No, I think that, you know, people are looking for answers to some extent, and they have been for a long time. I think that the idea of having something outside of ourselves, which is more powerful and has an impact and control over it, is, you know, something of a deep feeling that people have.
It explains a lot of religious
belief, if you will.
I think you're exactly right. If there is one message that I would like people to take away from my book, it is that we live in an orderly universe that is governed by physical laws. And they are laws that we can learn and use to our advantage, but they can't be circumvented. There is no magic, and it's just that simple.
1-800-423-8255, the Voodoo Science Connection with Dr. Robert Park. Paul is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Paul. Welcome.
Thank you. Some of the areas that Dr. Parks is labeling pseudo science are really not as open and shut as he would make them out to be. For example, homeopathy. There's been a double-blind study of the type that he has requested on so many times in the show. It's been done and published in The Lancet, a peer-reviewed journal, which of the type that he says is good science. Yet he's apparently not aware of this. And and to give a second example, in the area of the power lines, the Swedish government, the Swedish National Energy Administration, recently issued an advisory warning that schools, playgrounds, and daycare centers should not be sited near power lines, and they recommended that children not be subjected to magnetic field levels over 3 milligauss. So apparently he feels that they're practicing voodoo science and this official Swedish government policy. So these aren't open and shut cases, and the fact that, for example, the Lancet article on homeopathy is apparently ignored, there's some poor science being practiced on both sides here, I think.
Robert Park.
Well, the homeopathy article that you refer to, I wouldn't say it's been ignored, but it hasn't been replicated. And science simply does not take seriously a claim made in a single study. And that was not a very impressive study either. But as a matter of fact, I've had an international challenge with Jacques Benveniste, who is regarded as the as a scientist and who claims that to have evidence that that homeopathy works. I've had that claim that challenge with him for over a year, and he's refused to pick up the challenge. He agreed to do it, but has not yet submitted to the test. It's a very simple test. It's double blind. It's easy to do, but he simply won't do it.
But just stand by for a sec. You mentioned the placebo effect. A lot of these double-blinded tests on, modern medicine, some of the best, some of the most famous, show very questionable effect of
absolutely
stuff. I mean, are you as tough on the branded science as you are on homeopathy?
Given
the mystery of what cures people, you say they get better on their own, which we, praise God, do. But given the mystery of the placebo effect and what actually turns things around. Why not leave lots of room for not just homeopathy, but all the alternative medicines?
Oh, I think the placebo effect is not as mysterious as you imagine. It used to always be referred to as the mysterious placebo effect. I think it's not that mysterious at all now. There have been a lot of studies, a lot of advances in studies of the brain that begin to indicate what's really going on here. If you are sick or you're concerned about your health, the first thing that does is alert your body, that the brain signals the body that there is something to be worried about. And what the body does automatically when it's worried is try to ward off additional injury. And so it loads the bloodstream up with stress hormones. It's preparing you to ward off whatever it is that's causing you the problem. That may not be the best thing for healing. And so the first task of any physician is to reassure the patient that I understand your problem. There are things we can do for it. And follow my directions and you're going to feel better. And most people feel better before they leave the doctor's office, before they ever fill the prescription. Hmm. So I think we do understand pretty much what's going on in the placebo effect. We also know pretty well what it won't do. It won't shrink tumors. It won't grow hair on bald heads, even though there are studies that have been published that claim that it will.
But does that leave you more room for homeopathy than
no,
you suggested?
No,
maybe that has the same effect as the visit to the doctor.
I'm sure it does. That's exactly what it does, and that's why so many people will swear by it. It reassures them that they're doing something for themselves, and they begin to feel better almost immediately.
But you wouldn't say that going to the doctor is voodoo science. Even though it has the same sort of
halo
benefit.
Yeah, I think it's a responsibility of the doctor to try and calm and reassure his patients, and that's exactly what taking a placebo does. In the case of homeopathy, though, the case is for a scientist, in order for homeopathy to be right. So many things that science knows that work very, very well and over would have to be true. The evidence, once again, it's an extraordinary claim. This claim that you can dilute something until it no longer exists at all and still get some kind of a benefit from it is an extraordinary claim. And as you started out in your introduction, it requires extraordinary proof. And the extraordinary proof is just not there. In fact, there is almost no proof at all. The amount of testing that's been done on homeopathy, considering that it's been around for 200 years, is appallingly small.
Well, the evidence of its effect, well, I don't know. Are you being harder on homeopathy than you are on the simple benefit of going to the doctor, hearing a man with the letters after his name tell you you're going to be better?
I don't think I'm being harder on homeopathy. The question you raise is a good one, and a lot of people have said, if the placebo effect works, why not use it? And as I say, doctors really do use it all the time. In fact, before about the turn of the last century, about the middle of the last century, there wasn't much else that doctors had to treat people with, except aspirin and laxatives. But we do, incidentally, in responding to an earlier call, we do know now exactly how aspirin works. Most of modern pharmacology is based on the empiricism of the herbalist. Hmm. But modern science does something different. Instead of giving people willow bark, which is where aspirin was first identified, what you do is identify the active ingredient in the herb, you isolate it, you purify it, and you synthesize it. Then you can control it, you can do sensible studies with it, and it becomes what aspirin has become, a wonder drug. Really the first of the wonder drugs.
1-800-423-8255. The Voodoo Science Connection with Robert Park. Kevin is on the line.
Hello, Christopher and Dr. Park. I had a couple points and a question I wanted to make. I'm an engineer by profession and an amateur astronomist. And a couple of years ago, some astronomists made this projection that the Hubble.
Kevin, figure me. What's an astronomist as opposed to an astronomer?
Oh, sorry, astronomer.
Okay.
Excuse me. And that what they had done was made these projections that the Hubble constant was way off, and that looking at this one little area of the universe actually threw out all previous understanding, and then they had to retract that because they looked and they said, oh, we have to study a larger sample size. That may not be so any longer. And leading to my question, and that is, are some of these voodoo sciences, do the scientists feel that they have to project prematurely with anecdotal evidence in order to raise funding, keep their name public, and things like that, which would generally compromise the true science and collecting more data, which is clearly often the last task that has to be done, but it takes a lot of time.
You mean to say, is a certain amount of voodoo built into the sort of politics of research?
Exactly.
Okay.
Because it takes a lot of time to collect the real data to support the claim.
Robert Parr?
Sure. I think what you raise is an important and a serious question, and it is quite true. That often what happens here on this road from foolishness to fraud is that scientists believe, perhaps prematurely, perhaps they jump to a conclusion that they've made a discovery. If they go too publicly and too forcefully with that claim, it makes it more and more difficult to back down. Hmm. But mistakes are normal in science. None of us are going to get through a career in science without making a blooper or two. And most of us are going to acknowledge we've made a mistake when we discover that we have and put it behind us. So the voodoo, it becomes voodoo science when you don't put it behind you, when you you suddenly come to that that discovery that things are not working quite the way you imagined they were. Mm. And if you still persist in it, you're on the road to fraud.
1-800-423-8255. Peter is on the line from Nashua, New Hampshire.
Yes, good morning.
Hello, Peter.
Hi. My question to your guest is this. I'll ask the question and then hang up and listen to the answer. Is there, in the field of medicine anyway, is there some alternative to the double-blind studies? For example, combing over historical data and getting an idea as to what you'd expect without treatment. The reason I ask is that in medicine, you really get into problems with double-blind studies. For example, perhaps denying people who have an illness possible treatment of their illness, or even harming people in order to affect the double-blind study, for example, fake surgery. I'll hang up and listen to the answer. Thank you.
Peter, thank you.
Well, that's really a question of medical ethics, and it's certainly a serious one, and I know exactly what you're asking. There are things that you can do, but I think in the end, science is not going to be comfortable until that double-blind study is done. Mm-hmm. Looking at historical records, well, this is a sort of epidemiology. And epidemiology is often a clue as to what may be going on. But it's a tricky clue because there are so many confounding factors mm-hmm. that can be involved. For example, if you did a study of premature death, you would conclude that one of the most common factors in premature death is weight loss. Now, this doesn't mean that losing a few pounds is bad for your health. It means people that die prematurely often waste away. And so that's a confounding factor. It's a very simple one and easy to spot for an epidemiologist. But often the confounding factors are much more subtle than that. So in the end, at some point, you're going to have to do the double-blind study. And it's quite true that it's been very troubling that when you do the double-blind study, it means that the person who is not getting the medicine is not getting the chance to be healed. They are, in fact, making a sacrifice for the rest of society, if you will.
Hmm. Robert Park, I wish you could do this all day. There are many, many more arguments out there about voodoo calling itself science and maybe about science calling itself voodoo, but we'll come back to it. Thank you for the book. Thank you for joining us on The Connection, Robert Park. The book is Voodoo Science, The Road from Foolishness to Fraud. We had help today from John Marston, Michael Garth, Sam Vanderpoel, Matt Lieber, Tim Monroe, and Kim Bichari. Listeners, you can continue the Voodoo Science conversation on our website at theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Dan Furst, Hitesh Hatti, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, Jake Shapiro, and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Boston University, this is WBUR. Just ahead on Here and Now at Noon, a special report on legendary stage actress Julie Harris. We'll be hearing from her. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by...